It's getting awfully crowded in Kansas as more big names join the race to succeed Governor Laura Kelly. Quinton Lucas marking the midpoint of his last term. What's left on his to-do list? We have a report card on how he's delivered on his campaign promises. And just as Kansas City tries to present its best image ahead of the World Cup, here comes the Washington Post with a less than glamorous portrait of life in KC. Plus, no August recall election after all? Those stories are the rest of the week's news straight ahead.
Week in Review is made possible through the generous support of Dave and Jamie Cummings, Bob and Marlise Gourley, the Courtney S. Turner Charitable Trust, John H. Mize, and Bank of America N.A. co-trustees. The Francis Family Foundation, through the discretionary fund of David and Janice Francis. And by viewers like you. Thank you.
Hello and welcome. I'm Nick Haynes. Glad to have you with us on our weekly journey through the week's most impactful, confusing, and downright head-scratching local news stories. Hopping on board the Week in Review bus with us this week, former Star reporter and editorial writer Dave Helling, and current Star opinion columnist Patrick Toohey, who just got name-checked this week in the Washington Post. More on that in just a moment. Tracking the region's top political stories for KCUR News, Brian Ellison, and from our Metro's newest newspaper, Next Page KC, Eric Wesson. More on the race to succeed Laura Kelly as governor of Kansas straight ahead. But first, Mayor Lucas hits the midpoint of his final term, and he's marking the occasion by racking up the air miles. He was hard to catch this week. He was in Philadelphia on Monday for a summit of city leaders. Wednesday was in Chicago watching the Royals take on the Cubs at Wrigley Field. Friday, he headed to Cleveland for a top Democratic Party event. In between, his office says he was meeting with his staff to strategize on what he should do for the remainder of his short time left in office. We weren't in that meeting, but if you were, Eric, what would be the biggest item you would put on his final to-do list?
Do something about the crime. Do something about the homelessness. On my way here today.
I did hear, though, this week, weren't they finally got agreement to open a low-barrier homeless shelter in Kansas City?
They've done that before. They hired somebody that was earmarked to do that. If you get off on Van Brunt and I-70, it's a car wash there that is now a motel. People have moved into the stalls and they're living in those areas.
Eric mentioned crime. Is that still the biggest unmet campaign promise, Patrick?
Yeah, it has to be, and it's demonstrably so. Mayor Lucas ran saying he wanted to keep the homicide rate under 100, and not only did he fail to do that, we've seen a peak. This year, we may have the second highest homicide rate ever in Kansas City. And to Eric's point, what Kansas City and a lot of cities are failing to do is provide the basic services. They get distracted by the nice-to-haves, the wanna-haves, but really what we need is public safety, transit, and infrastructure, and that's it.
Does he still have time to fix that before he leaves office?
Homicide? Lord, no. No, I can't imagine what he's going to do that he hasn't tried to do in the past 6 years.
To that point, I think we can name this as a problem, but we can recognize also the complexity of the problem and the limited tools that any one part of our government or one particular public leader has to solve it. Certainly, the state-controlled police board might be a piece of that. The resources that the city has available to devote to crime prevention, the willingness of the city council to support those efforts are all pieces of that. But I think there's no question that when the story is told of Quinton Lucas's mayorship, the crime problem will be the thing that people continue to talk about.
What should be left on his to-do list before he leaves office, Dave?
Well, I agree with, of course, my colleagues that the crime rate in Kansas City is the number one problem, and everything else is number 10 on the list. I mean, crime occupies the first 9 places. But just for the sake of diversity, there are a couple of other things that are coming up. First, the stadium debacle has to be settled one way or another in the next 2 years.
If that doesn't happen, though, we're not going to pin the blame on Quinton Lucas, though. He's not the poster child, the name that goes on that, is he?
Rightly or wrongly, if the Chiefs and or the Royals leave, even though, by the way, it was Quinton Lucas who said that a downtown baseball stadium was a Maserati when he was running for office and quickly changed his mind, but he'll carry some of the responsibility if the Chiefs or the Royals, particularly the Royals, go somewhere else. So that's important. And then I do think in the next 2 years, he'll want to pay some attention to what happens with the Plaza. And, you know, if that shopping district continues to be one-third empty, That will also be seen as something the mayor could have had some impact on. So, again, it's crime. Nobody would even dispute that it's crime. But those are a couple of other things that might be on his plate.
If in the next 2 years the stadium issue is not resolved, will we really, as a public, be blaming Quinton Lucas, Patrick?
Gosh, that's a great question. I am amazed at how all the parties in this debacle seem to have failed, from the team owners to the politicians on both sides of state line. I want to read the book that comes out in 10 years about what's going on behind the scenes, but it's very difficult from the outside to know who's the good guy.
Okay, you're on chapter 3 currently of that book, Dave, am I right?
Well, I am retired, so I have some writing time on my hands, but Patrick is completely right that all sides deserve, in fact, I've written this for the newspaper, all sides deserve approbation for the way they've approached this issue over the last several years, and that does not exclude the teams. The teams have had problems deciding what they want to do. The politicians have been horrible on this issue. No one comes out of this smelling good.
If you listen to the backroom conversations, if they had kept the baseball stadium in East Village, instead of moving it to Crossroads, they got a pushback. They got people more engaged in the process. That was Mayor Lucas's idea, was to put it there and connect it to
So you certainly put a little bit of a finger of blame on him.
Yes.
What, you know, he's got 2 years left. We're at that midpoint now. Are we any the wiser as to what he does when he leaves office? He's still a very young man. I can't believe he's just going to go back to being a law professor at the University of Kansas, Brian.
My sources close to the White House say it's very unlikely he'll be offered a position in the Trump administration.
Okay.
I think, first of all, it is 2 years left, Nick. I think this might be just a little premature to be writing the final chapter of that's a quarter of his entire tenure, if he finishes his term. But as to what he does next, I think the general trajectory of the political system in the country have somewhat narrowed the options and the things he was willing to consider. Obviously, folks speak about congressional race. People speak about other opportunities in the state, but those seem very limited for a city leader from Kansas City who's a Democrat.
Let's stick with city matters for a moment. With food assistance programs being cut all across the country, more cities are now considering publicly funded grocery stores, including the leading candidate to be the next mayor of New York City. But a Washington Post story this week says Kansas City offers a cautionary tale. The Post points out how the city poured millions into the Sunfresh supermarket at 31st and Prospect, and yet it's now on the brink of closure, pointing out rotten odors and empty shelves.
Around here, a good thing don't last too long. I watch people walk in and walk out. I can tell you today, right now, it's damn near dead.
Now, we've talked about this issue before, but now it's getting national eyeballs on the story, Eric, exactly at the time that we're supposed to be cleaning up our image, showing, projecting strength and how wonderful we are ahead of the World Cup. And then here comes the Washington Post with this story. I mean, what went wrong, and is it too late to fix it?
The city was slow to respond to a lot of issues that were going on there.
He's getting emotional about it.
there was a lot that was going on that the city was slow to respond to. The crime in the area. And I think people need to get a clarity. They did put the money into the entire shopping center. All of that money didn't go into
the grocery store. When we're talking about more than $20 million, which is referenced in the story, we're talking about the whole shopping center, not just that grocery store. So that gives a bit of a false impression.
Right.
But don't we want cities, though, if there are issues of getting fresh produce in certain parts of our community, that you want government to step in and trying to help out? And wasn't this a noble effort to do that, Patrick?
Certainly people want government to step in and try to help out, but we really need to judge these things by how effective they are. And I think this was doomed from the beginning. First of all, that grocery store had already sat vacant for 10 years when the city got involved, which tells you that private investors looked at this and decided it wasn't a good idea. There were other grocery stores serving that area. We didn't have a food desert, as a lot of people talked about. But ultimately, what the city needs to do is provide for those basics. And if a city has public safety, if they have transit, if they support infrastructure, then private investors can come in and meet the need. But when the city skips those basic things and tries to jump to the end to provide amenities, the writing's on the wall.
You know, the Post also exposes lots of other problems, from unchecked crime to the city's lack of a jail. I mean, this was everything that they were presenting to the country that we perhaps don't want to have seen as ahead of this biggest event we're holding in our history.
Yeah, of course we don't. But the reality, too, is that a lot of visitors to Kansas City will never see that grocery store, will not see even the crime problems that we've already talked about on this program, because the experience of the daily life of a lot of Kansas Cityans is invisible to a good many other Kansas Cityans, much less visitors to the city. I think our problems as a city are a little more systemic than that and not easily reduced to a comment on how it will affect World Cup visitors.
And, you know, provocatively, Ingram's magazine this week claims Kansas City should put out an alert to World Cup visitors. The local business magazine reports nothing on the official Kansas City World Cup website warns visitors that they have a 10 times better chance of being murdered in Kansas City than they would in New York City. Do we not have an obligation to tell them?
I think we do have an obligation to present the best possible Kansas City we can present. Now, whether that's kind of sugarcoating some of the real underlying issues that we have here, I think that they have to market, and nobody's going to say, hey, don't come here because you're going to get killed. But can I just back up for one second? The thing about the Lynnwood Shopping Center Sunfresh is it serves a lot of elderly people that don't have transportation or means to go to other grocery stores.
Just quickly, nothing in Kansas City panics leadership more than bad publicity in a national publication. Yep. You could write about Sunfresh and the Lynnwood Shopping Center as the Star's done and all the people around this table have done for years. Suddenly it's in the Washington Post and the crisis is upon us, which is always a frustrating thing. And the other thing to keep in mind is, while perhaps a warning is exaggerated, some sort of notice, hey, you know, make sure you know what you're doing if you're a visitor and the places you should and shouldn't go. The fact is the other cities are not blameless or immune to these problems. If you think Kansas City has a homeless problem, go to Los Angeles. I mean, Los Angeles, half of the people there are living under a bridge.
I don't know I don't know that's a winning pitch for Kansas City.
No, but I'm not.
We're not Los Angeles.
But of course, my job isn't to have a winning pitch for Kansas City. My job is to try as a reporter and demonstrate reality as it is. And the fact is that all urban areas have challenges. We have more than most in some areas. In other places, we're doing fine.
If you haven't been keeping score, the race for governor in Kansas just got a whole lot more crowded this week. It's not quite the Dirty Dozen, but the number of Kansans who looked in the mirror and saw the next governor looking back at them has now grown to 11. The latest to join the race, Kansas Senate President Ty Masterson.
Donald Trump is taking D.C. head on, and he is taking the country back. It's time we elect that same thing here.
Most of the action is on the Republican ticket. You've got four big political names elbowing each other for attention. Senate President Ty Masterson, former Governor Jeff Collier, Secretary of State Scott Schwab, and Insurance Commissioner Vicky Schmidt. Who has the easiest path to being nominated,
do you think? Don't forget Jeff Collier, the former Lieutenant Governor who's run before. As the field on the Republican side widens, the bar you have to clear to get the nomination shrinks. And so people with name recognition and some history with the party are presumably the favorites. Masterson is fairly well known. The next session, by the way, will be incredible to watch because of his candidacy. But maybe Collier, you know, maybe some of the other Republicans who are seeking to run will have to spend some time getting their names before the Republican public again. I'm still waiting on Kris Kobach. Someone may have intelligence that I don't have, but I think Kobach still wants to be governor. If he runs, he would be the favorite.
Now, some other remarkable things happening actually on the Democratic side of the governor's race this week. Are we about to see something exceedingly rare, a competitive Democratic primary for governor as the second Johnson County Democratic senator throws his hat into the ring, Ethan Corson. But perhaps the biggest surprise this week is who isn't joining the campaign. Laura Kelly's running mate, Lieutenant Governor Dave Toland, said he would not seek the office. That's an unexpected stunner. What happened? Wasn't he considered the front runner on the Democratic side?
He was, or at least one of the front runners because of his experience with Laura Kelly. But Laura Kelly's reaction to this race is fascinating. On X this week, the former Twitter, she was effusive in her praise of Ethan Corson to the expense of Cindy Holscher, about whom she said nothing. And that suggests that he will have some help in this race that she will not.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to think that that's unconnected to the decision of the lieutenant governor, Toland, to not run. And I don't know that anybody saw that coming. Now, having said that, no one would ever have accused Dave Toland of stealing the spotlight from Laura Kelly during his tenure. I'm not sure that he made that many motions that suggested he was really excited about being governor, and especially about running for governor as a Democrat with a very uphill battle, no matter who the Republican opponent is. So I'm not so shocked that he decided not to run, but I think the timing suggests that a full-on endorsement of Ethan Corson is probably on the way from the governor, and that really changes expectations in that race.
And what happens to Laura Kelly? I mean, she's now only got a year left. You said about, well, there's a lot of time for Quinton Lucas, but she's only got a year left. I mean, does she just ride off into the sunset?
My sources indicate she is not going to be offered a position in the Trump administration.
Okay. If I was just as well-wired at the White House as Brian, I could revive my moribund career. I think that, again, I think there is still some pressure on her to run against Roger Marshall, but I don't think increasingly it looks like she'll decline that opportunity. So she may just take senior status, much like Kathleen Sebelius, and work behind the scenes. Quickly before we leave this topic, though, Nick, who knows who Ethan Corson is? I mean, that name is really unfamiliar to most Kansans. He's from Prairie Village. Cindy Holscher is also a local product. That's an interesting development for Democrats. But whoever the nominee is really going to need a boost in the general election.
It doesn't help that he's also from Johnson County.
Yes, correctly. Correct.
Sure I'm sure we'll talk about that more in the coming year, but Ethan Corson from Fairway, a relatively newcomer to the state legislature compared to Cindy Holscher, but he does have this national experience, this experience at the national level that suggests he's probably more tied to Democratic leaders and maybe Democratic money.
Jackson County Executive Frank White has done something no one else has been able to accomplish over the past year. He's managed to knock the stadium story off the front page. White's fate has become Kansas City's newest and biggest political drama. This week we learn a little more about the recall election that could oust him from office while we're still waiting for a judge to rule on whether a recall election can be held and when. We've been told local election officers aren't even preparing for an August ballot any longer. So what are they preparing for, Eric?
Well, one is preparing for the judge to rule. That's Jackson County. It's my understanding that the Kansas City Election Board is preparing for it. They just haven't put any dates on anything.
The court is going to rule. I think what they're probably going to have to prepare for is whenever it happens, it's going to happen. What I think is interesting is that we're still learning more about how this unfolds and what even happens after a recall occurs. We, of course, as we shared last time I brandished copies of the county charter.
Even with public broadcasting cuts,
yes,
you were able to print off some copies of the charter.
I use double-sided.
Okay. So,
but the reality is that the replacement occurs at the hands of the county legislature, not with a new election immediately. The new permanent county executive doesn't get elected until what would have been the end of Frank White's term at the end of 2026.
I actually found that it's surprising. So I assumed that if voters were to recall Frank White, we would then have an election to decide who his replacement should be. But actually, the legislators themselves will decide. And I'm assuming then if they're the ones doing the picking, aren't they more likely to pick one of their own than an outsider to be in that role?
I am sure there is all sorts of politicking going on among them to determine who's going to follow up Frank White. But this is what kind of makes the difficult issue for me, is that I don't know what's coming next. I am not confident at all that if Frank White is removed, that property assessments get any better or a stadium negotiation gets any better. This just seems to be, let's get rid of this one guy, and we're not talking about what comes next and what will change.
And what, actually, if he survives the recall effort, whenever that election takes place, Eric, how would government be then if he still maintains that position, and how difficult will it be to get things done then?
I think everybody would, one, be in a state of shock if he did survive a recall, but I think it would be confusing as to the candidates that want to be the interim. All of them come in saying, hey, I want to fix the assessment problem. I'm going to fix it. I know how to fix it. So whether or not they'll be able to gel together as one, like they should be, I think that remains to be seen.
I mean, a cynical person might answer your question, Nick, with, well, what are they getting done now? Every story that we've talked about and that most media have talked about over the past many months has been either about Frank White and the possible recall, about anger and frustration over tax assessments and the apparent inability to resolve the situation, has been about bickering among legislature members, or in some cases, criminal charges against legislature members. I'm not sure much would be different if Frank White survived the election. At least some people would say this tenure has already had a really rough go.
Has Donald Trump put the final nail in the coffin of any chance that the Kansas City Chiefs would change their name? This week, the president says he will block a new stadium deal for the NFL's Washington Commanders unless they restore their former Redskins name. I always thought it was conceivable that the Chiefs might consider a name change if they were to move from Arrowhead, and build a new stadium. But does the president's actions this week signal that we're further away than ever from a Chiefs rebrand, Dave?
Well, we're far away from a Chiefs rebrand because the Chiefs steadfastly refuse to rebrand. They have, I mean, I've written that story several times. I've talked to Chiefs leadership. They just really believe in that name. They believe it adds to their success on the field. They just have no interest in trying some other alternative, either renaming the current stadium or renaming their team. It has nothing to do, really, with what President Trump has said.
I grew up in Washington, D.C. I've always known the team as the Redskins. I still have Redskins merchandise, which I protect. I can't imagine that the fever, the national moral panic over teams' names will extend any further and certainly won't cause the Chiefs to change.
I will just say briefly, we wrote a lot about the chop, the tomahawk chop, which is, in certain parts of Kansas City, causes a cringe every time it happens. The Chiefs won't even try and stop that. Again, they think it's part of what they're doing.
And to respond to Patrick's point, I think there are a lot of parts of the Kansas City community who would not think of this as a national fever. They would think about this as matters of dignity and identity regarding their status as Native Americans and indigenous people whose imagery and language is being used to cause implicit oppression of them.
But the chief is named after a man who was a historic person here in Kansas
City. That is baloney.
They named him.
Troll Bartle. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's just baloney. Always has been.
The University of Kansas's mascot, the Jayhawkers, were domestic terrorists from the Civil War. If no one's going to get upset about that name, then I'm not impressed with getting upset over others.
Now, before we get to our big story miss segment, just a quick note to let you know about what's been happening behind the scenes here at the station 1 week after all our federal funding was cut. Three quick take-homes. Hiring is on hold. Two, travel has been restricted. And perhaps the biggest news of all, our decades-old Kansas City PBS magazine and member guide is going away. Yes, I thought you might say that. It's about a $300,000 a year effort that, with all the printing and the mailing cost, it'll be the most noticeable early casualty of the funding cuts. We'll keep you posted regularly about what else is happening. Now, when you put a program like this together every week, you can't get to every story grabbing the headlines. What was the big local story we missed? At least one fatality this week from a deluge of rain. It's the second week in a row that local flooding forces emergency responders to conduct water rescues. The Chiefs head north as training camp gets underway in St. Joseph. Ted Lasso begins filming in Kansas City, surprising shoppers on the plaza this week. Is Penway Point in trouble? The Ferris wheel is up, but complaints build over weeds and a halt to construction. There's no word on when the rest of the development might be built. Early voting now underway in the Wyandotte County Mayor's race. Six candidates are campaigning to succeed Tyrone Garner, who is not running for re-election. Fearing for its funding, KU eliminates gender pronouns in official communications from emails to Zoom calls. And many of you have complained about kids on scooters and e-bikes. Overland Park now considering a major crackdown.
Thing is, a large number are head injuries.
A lot of confusion, really, about what are the rules, where are folks supposed to be? Are they supposed to be on the sidewalk or in the street?
Actually, you traveled here by scooter, Eric, so I'm just wondering whether the concern over a potential crackdown was your top story missed.
I'm shaking in my boots. I chose Ted going to Gates and bringing a positive spin on Kansas City. Maybe they could use that for the World Cup for people coming in as a marketing tool.
Brian.
After a long wait on Thursday morning, the Streetcar Authority announced that the Southern Extension will open on Friday, October 24th. Mm. We'll connect residents and people who work in the city to a wide range of restaurants and businesses and UMKC, and someday, perhaps, me to a downtown baseball stadium. We'll see.
Absolutely. And so you can finally go shopping on the plaza and leave your car at home, Patrick.
I can't wait for that. So the story I pick, I'll shamelessly promote one of my columns, was that the unified government of Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas, did away with their parking mandates for a number of years in the old part of downtown. This is a great move that gets an unnecessary and costly regulation out of the way from developers and people who want to build homes and people who just want to be entrepreneurs and open restaurants.
Yeah, and so it, there used to be things like you had to have 3 parking spaces per how many feet of space, and that went away.
It's a nightmare in Kansas City, Missouri to figure this out, but moves by KCK and even by St. Louis show that maybe cities are learning that what they need to do to increase development is get out of the way.
Dave.
This week, the Trump administration withdrew federal loan guarantees for the Grain Belt Express. Mm. That's a power transmission project to bring power from the wind fields in Kansas into Missouri and then through Missouri to other communities. That will become critical, Nick, because every community in America wants to build a data center, which sucks electricity and water, but electricity, like almost no other development in the world. And so the ability to produce power and move it to where it's needed is going to be a huge issue in the next decade.
And on that, we will say our week has been reviewed, courtesy of star contributing opinion columnist Patrick Toohey and Eric Wesson from Next Page KC. From KCUR, Brian Ellison and news icon Dave Helling, and I'm Nick Haynes from all of us here at Kansas City PBS. Be well, keep calm, and carry on.